You know, I called my aunt this week because she lives 60 miles north of Mount St. Helens and was there when it erupted. And I said, what was it like? And she said, besides the explosion and the lava and all of the things you saw just in that video, she said the thing that was most striking was that the air was filled with this fine flour, she described it as. And that fine flour was so fine that it would immediately get sucked into your air cleaners in your car, and you couldn't drive but a mile, and suddenly your car stopped working because it was clogged with air. You couldn't take the air filter out because then it would just clog up your engine, so people were abandoning their cars, and there was really no way of escape. In fact, her husband, I guess my aunt's husband is my uncle-in-law, but anyway, he was actually a helicopter pilot, and he was the first one to fly people back in from the USGS Geological Society to start surveying the damage after that thing blew up. And maybe you haven't seen that before, or you've heard the story before. It was quite an amazing account. And I think a volcano is often a metaphor we use when we think about danger, when we think about things that in advance, why didn't they see the warnings? Why didn't people get free? But also sometimes we use that to talk about how we get angry ourselves. I blew my top on that one kind of thing. So today in our series Heroic, I want to look at anger through the perspective of Mount St. Helens and look at the fact that heroes know how to monitor seismic activity before they blow up. And anger is not a bad thing. There are things to get angry about. There are appropriate things to be angry about. But anger needs to be partnered with wisdom so it can be handled wisely. So we're going to look at how wisdom can help us as we encounter anger in our life. Wisdom acts as a seismograph. It acts as a cryptodome. It also acts as a helicopter. As we come back to that story we just heard about how Mike rescued people who had really made some pretty dumb decisions to stay in a very dangerous place. I'll give an example of my life. Beth and I bought a new couch set about 6 months ago, and my son can be pretty hard on stuff just because he's always rocking and shaking and kicking. I've got a 16-year-old son who has autism, and so he's kind of hard on stuff. And so one of the couches began to kind of get worn out already. So I called him up, and I'm like, hey, what do I need to fill out to get this thing fixed? I don't know if it's covered by the warranty, and I couldn't get a hold of anybody, which is kind of irritating. I had to go talk to a phone system, and I get a text back, but I couldn't talk live. I had a text. I'm already kind of annoyed, right? So I'm texting back, and so they send me the paperwork. I fill out all the paperwork. I send it back, and then they text me back a couple days later and say, sir, we have no record that you bought this here. You know what? I do not need another chore to do. It's been frustrating enough that this thing's not working. It's frustrating enough I had to fill out the paperwork. Now you're telling me you don't even know that I bought the thing there? So I said, well, I was there 6 months ago. And they said, well, we found something you bought here three years ago. Yeah, 3 years ago, but this is something I bought 6 months ago. We'll check, sir. We can't find anything. I'm getting more and more irritated. These people got terrible record keeping. How are they going to honor my warranty if they can't even know if I even bought the thing? I'm getting more and more frustrated. And as I'm getting angry, and as I'm getting impatient, my wife turns to me and is like, why are you so angry and judgmental and impatient? And what I wanted to say is, are you being patient with my impatience? Are you judging my judgmentalism? But I didn't. I used some wisdom to not say that. And as I was getting angrier and angrier, I went, what if I'm the one that's wrong? Like I caught myself like, oh, I'm really getting riled up here. So I text her back and say, after all the previous texts that were pretty emphatic that they had blown it, I said, you know what? Thanks for checking. I'll do a little more research. I found the paperwork. I bought it at a different store. I was the one who had the bad paperwork. I was the one to keep the records. I get all angry and all upset, and I was so glad, though I'd gone farther than I wanted to, that I at least had the wisdom to apologize before I realized how wrong I was. So how do we do that? And how do we, when we didn't do that, repair what we've been done? So number one, we're going to look at wisdom when it comes to anger is like a seismograph. So if you've ever seen a seismograph, it's always in the movies, right? It's da-dee-dee-dee-dee, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It's telling you that there's a problem coming. And as you saw in the video, there's 10,000 earthquakes happened before this thing blew up. You're like, surely everyone could have got saved, right? And people were being evacuated. But how many times in our own life do we not see, I'm carrying some hurt, it's really irritating me, this has really been bothering me on the inside, I'm really letting this build up over time, I haven't found a healthy way to deal with this. When you see wisdom as a seismograph, you realize I need to delay the rage and heed the warnings in my own body, in my own soul, in the fact I can feel myself kind of building up before I cross the line. Maybe I'm feeling unappreciated, maybe it's at night where it's harder to maybe have some self-control. Do you recognize the seismograph in your own life? Now, if you look at Mount St. Helens, kind of when you look at a geological survey or some of the diagrams you'll see in geology class, it'll show that most volcanoes shoot straight up. And in 1980, almost all the geologists had only seen or heard about volcanoes that go straight up. They'd never heard of one going sideways. But there were still indicators. There was all of these steam vents literally coming out of the ground, not just at top, warning something's happening. Didn't that kind of happen with you before you blow your top? It's kind of steam going. You can find the buildup of pressure. Well, right at the top, instead of blowing out the side, it had what was called a cryptodome, which began to push out the side. All that lava and pressure was moving outward to the outside, building up with no way to vent. In fact, if you saw a picture of that in the 1980s, I'll put a picture up here, that's what it looked like before it blew. Now you look at that and you're like, well, surely somebody knew a problem's coming. But no one before that had seen a volcano shoot sideways. So even someone named David Johnson, who worked for the Geological Society, was sitting right in the path of that section of the mountain, literally 13 hours before the eruption, right there at the base of it, like taking notes. Shouldn't he have known better? Shouldn't he have realized this is a problem? How could somebody so smart, so educated in this subject, well, he had never seen a mountain blow out the side, and therefore he didn't heed the warnings. So let me talk about anger for a second from a Bible perspective. There's a story in the Bible. You may have heard a guy named Jonah and the whale, but you may not know kind of the background. Jonah is pretty justifiably angry. He's sent to Nineveh, and this place in Nineveh represents his enemies. I mean, like literal enemies who have tortured his family members and his fellow townspeople, destroyed their town. He hates the Ninevites, which is the capital city of the Assyrian Empire. God says, hey, those people are doing the wrong thing, but I want you to know, I want you to tell them they're doing the wrong thing because I want to forgive them and be merciful to them. He's like, No. We can be angry at them. We can send lightning bolts to them, but we're not going to offer a chance to change to them. So he heads off the other direction, gets thrown off a ship, swallowed by a whale, spit back out, going the wrong direction. Fine, God. So he marches through town of these enemies he hates and is angry at. As he walks through the town, he doesn't preach a very a very inviting message. Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. He cried out and said, 40 days, Nineveh's going to be overthrown, yeah! It's not exactly what God told him to say. He's just angry at his enemies, and understandably so. The people do change, despite the turn or burn message he gave. Man, we have messed up, we've done the wrong thing, we need forgiveness, we need God's leadership. And now Jonah's even angrier. Angry is how the chapter ends. He can't believe that God would accept their forgiveness, accept their changes. So he, Jonah, pouting and angry at God, says, oh, Lord, was this not what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore, I fled. This is why I left. I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness. It's the Old Testament God. One who relents, doesn't want to do harm. Look at that word, slow to anger. Now, that's not to say that justice doesn't come and consequences don't come. There isn't a time to be angry. But God is slow to anger, slow to put consequences in place. He wants to relent from doing harm. He wants people to change, if at all possible, before the consequences come. Now, 200 years later, that same town, 150 years later, decides to go back to their old ways. I mean, talking about murder, terrible things. And the book of Nahum, is another prophet's name, Nahum, comes to the same city. And look what he says. Again, the Lord is slow to anger, great in power, but he also will not acquit the wicked. He's a good judge. He can't just let evil go. And he uses a volcano analogy. The Lord has his way. The mountains could quake before his power. Who could possibly endure the fierceness of his anger if he didn't hold it back? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. Now, how can these both be true? How can it simultaneously be this powerful volcanic anger that no one could stand against, and he's slow to anger? Well, in Hebrew, the phrase slow to anger is really unusual. I talked about this a couple years ago, but the term slow to anger means long of nose. God is long of nose when it comes to anger. And in the Middle Eastern culture, if somebody gets angry, their nose turns red. And so if you see somebody angry, it's like, whoa, his whole face is red, his nose is red, he's gonna get all growly. So they use that idiom to say God is long-nosed. It takes a long time for his nose to get red. Now, he's still upset about some things, just like you've been upset about things that have happened to you or people have done. In fact, there's a thinker on this named Becky Pippert, and I love her quote. I've been thinking about this for probably 20 years. I keep coming back to this quote. She talks about how there is a type of anger that's motivated by love and a type that's motivated not by love. She said, "How did I feel? I was grieved and sickened to see the wasted potential, but I also felt fury. Everything in me wanted to shake this person in my life. Can't you see? Don't you know what you're doing to yourself? You seem less and less yourself every time I see you. I wasn't angry because I hated them. I was angry because I cared. If I hadn't loved them, I could have walked away. But love detests that which destroys the beloved. Real love stands against deception. The more a father loves his son, the more he hates in his son the drunkard, the liar, and the traitor." See, anger has a place, but also needs to be displayed wisely, slow to anger, long-nosed. Now, one of the classic stories, if you ever study Mount St. Helens, is a guy by the name of Harry Truman. Not the president, different Harry Truman. Harry R. Truman was this kind of woodsy guy that lived right at the base of Mount St. Helens. He became a meme and a viral video before there were viral videos. He says, "I live at the base of the mountain, I've always lived at the base of the mountain, and I'm not moving." And they're coming to him showing the facts, showing the reality, seismograph, everything. "I'm not going to do it. Me and my dogs have lived here our whole life." He becomes a celebrity. Like all the news fly helicopters in just to sit in line to interview this guy, Harry Truman, who just basically says the same thing over again. "No, no, 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 no." They have all the kids in the school districts there write letters to Mr. Harry Truman. "Dear Harry, please, we don't want you to die. Please leave." Doesn't take any of their advice. He doesn't have to worry about it. And you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. But don't we do that too? I mean, you've had your spouse mention your anger issue. Ah, she's just too sensitive. Oh, you've had your kids mention that you kind of blow up. Ah, they don't get what it's like to be a good dad. Oh, you don't realize I'm Irish. You don't realize that's what my dad was. We have all these crazy reasons we have for not dealing with the feedback that's all around us. And sure enough, Harry Truman was at the base of that mountain when it blew forth, covering up him, his poor dogs, and his entire house. And a month later, they found out that Harry Truman had a different house he owned that he could have gone to the entire time. And for many of us, we grew up having anger modeled, if you feel it, you say it, in a very unhealthy way. And we don't realize there's another house, there's another way. There's another way to still have anger. There's appropriate times to be angry, but there's appropriate ways to display anger as well. Let's not be like Harry Truman and end up as a name because the other people who got damaged because of what we said and what we did with our words. That's wisdom as a seismograph. Second is wisdom as a cryptodome. So what's a cryptodome? I alluded to it already a little bit, but heroes know how to relinquish judgment in order to vent the steam. In other words, in order to vent the steam properly, I need to be able to hand judgment over to someone else who's qualified, who will be impartial, who will be fair. And if I don't have someone I can trust to be impartially fair, I'm going to keep track of who deserves what lightning bolts and what they did and what they said. Some cryptodomes are at the top of the mountain, and they vent steam. It takes some of that pressure off. The one at Mount St. Helens was actually growing out the side. If you look at it, you can see that cryptodome again, and just the big bulge. It was growing at 5 feet per day for 60 days. That mountain was growing. And what scientists tell us is that this problem occurred thousands of years earlier. The sulfur gas, and that's what my aunt said, the whole place smelled, reeked of rotten eggs. That sulfuric gas began even thousands of years earlier on the mountain. And it actually came up about a third away in the mountain. It created almost like a Teflon plate deep underneath the mountain. The mountain was already sick on the inside. So when that cryptodome explodes, it allows the whole side of the mountain to slide along that sulfuric acid mixed in there underneath the mountain. And that's why the whole mountain literally slid off, because there was something deep inside that was broken, that smelled bad, that was just not the way it should be. And you'll notice there's no smoke coming out. This particular cryptodome didn't have a way to vent the steam. And that's what the Bible uniquely offers, that God is an impartial God who does judge, but he does it fairly and appropriately. And if you're struggling with bitterness or anger because something horrible happened, and I don't doubt it was horrible, you need to be able to hand that, relinquish that judgment to someone so you don't have to carry that burden. That's why in Nahum it goes on to say, God is a jealous and an avenging God. "Oh, that's what I don't like about the church. I don't really like God of the Old Testament." That is such an American way of thinking. In that, in a lot of cultures, where the police come in and are bribed by the gangs or bribed by the cartels, you're hungering for God to come in and give justice. You need someone who you can trust to fairly, mercifully, but truthfully and execute, bring justice in place. Let me play out both those words, and I'll show you how it gets practical. So jealous. Oprah once said she did not like the God of the Bible because he describes himself as jealous. And she saw jealousy always as an insecure word, which makes sense. It kind of feels that way sometimes. And yet I've been with couples where one of them has betrayed the other's marriage vows, and they come in to see me, and the one who betrayed says to me that their spouse, who was betrayed, shouldn't be so angry. The healthiest thing that you have when something that belongs to two of you people gets violated, gets stolen, gets shared with someone else, that is a healthy emotion. Jealous love is something that belongs to us was shared with someone else. That is a healthy emotion. It's not insecure in that context. It shows passion for what we have together, what we committed to, what's important to us. Same thing's true of God. He is so committed to us that he's jealous when we give away our affections or handle our life in inappropriate ways. Now, this idea that we need to relinquish judgment to some impartial judge is so practical. John Piper is kind of a thought leader in this area. He says, laying down the burden of anger does not mean that there was no wrong done against you. No justice is going to be served. It doesn't mean you're not going to get vindicated. It doesn't mean they got away with it. No, when you lay down the burden of vengeance, God picks it up. God, I'm going to trust you to give justice because I'm wearing myself out trying to keep track of it myself. See that? There's a philosopher named Miroslav Volf, who grew up in Croatia. And Croatia had civil wars and just people do terrible things to one group, then they would do that terrible thing and escalate, and just all the anger continued to escalate. And he got to see firsthand how the message of Jesus and the message of God began to transform the culture as people who had terrible things done against them decided to trust judgment to God and begin to find a way to be human again. Here's what he says. He goes, belief in God's just judgment and your commitment to nonviolence are essential for forgiveness. Without assured justice, God's going to take care of that, forgiveness becomes a cruel joke. When one knows the torturer will not eternally triumph, one is free to rediscover their humanity. And he got to see that in real time in Croatia as people who had terrible things done against each other's villages learned how to forgive and be human again by entrusting the consequences to what had happened to a righteous judge. And he knows it firsthand. In fact, it was his brother who was actually riding on the back of a truck with soldiers. And one of the soldiers was irresponsible at best, negligent maybe. And because of that, his brother, when he was young, fell off the truck and died. And that soldier was just sick over it, honestly. He just wasn't intentional, just sick over it. So much so he literally was hospitalized for just how terrible he felt at what he had done. And Miroslav's father heard about this soldier. He was angry. He took my son. But he also decided he didn't want to live in bitterness. So Miroslav entrusted that situation to the God of the Bible, drove hours to that hospital bed, said it to the soldier who'd killed his own son, and said, I want you to know that I'm not going to harbor bitterness towards you. And I know a God who's forgiven me of things I've done when I killed his son, and I forgive you as well. Oh. Whoa. So when you hear Miroslav talk about this, he's talking from experience. So think about that when it comes to Mount St. Helens. How much damage has been done by your or my inability to handle our anger properly or wisely? And you think about that mountaintop, it looks so good, almost like a Mount Fuji at its moment. And then just in a few moments, a few days, a few months, suddenly you have all the trees destroyed for 200 acres, right? You suddenly have cars buried in mud over what happened. You have this mountain that is just literally blown up all around, like somebody took an ice cream scoop and scooped it out. This beautiful mountain, that's what it looks like. And let me show you the video of just what it looked like when it exploded. And ask yourself this. It's easy to see the damage after we blow our top, right? So then you realize, oh, I can't believe what I said last night. Oh, I can't believe, I'm just so tired, I just let things go, I shouldn't have said that. You see the tears in your spouse's eyes. You see your kids who are just melting under your last speech and how it was expressed. And you say to yourself, I wish I could go back. How do I repair this? How do I fix this? What if that crypto dome that just keeps blowing up in your marriage or at work or cost you a first marriage or cost you a job, what if it's time to look underneath like that crypto dome and say, all this stuff, I don't need to just control it better. I need to figure out what's that sickness that maybe has been in me from what was modeled for me by my parents. I need to get a little better than they do. Maybe there's something deep underneath the surface that kind of has come, some smelly hurt I haven't dealt with, some story I keep telling, some bitterness I've been holding on to. Maybe it's time for me to go under the surface and deal with this before I keep blowing up and hurting the people I care about. Wouldn't it be better to deal with that before that moment, that conversation, that annoying thing becomes an explosion that loosens all that inner brokenness that traces back to things that happened a long time ago? See, wisdom is both a seismograph, it's also a cryptodome, but lastly, it's a helicopter. And here's the good news about the Bible. God warns us, he tells us what to do, and most of the time we don't listen. Most of the time we're like, I tried, I failed. Wisdom is also a helicopter that says, even though you didn't do it right, even though you kind of crossed over the lines, you didn't, I'm a helicopter that will come in and rescue you even when you've done dumb things. Whole Bible's about people doing dumb things and how God can help you when you do dumb things. And real heroes rescue us from evil. And one of the main metaphors of the Bible and stories of the Bible and accounts of the Bible is that the God of the universe saw us going wayward, blowing up, being egocentrical, do everything wrong. He could have just said, that's it, you know what? No. He came to earth at great cost to himself, allowed himself to be crucified by the hatred and anger of mankind in order to rescue us from this world and from ourselves. Because he knows that we often don't do what we're supposed to do, and he wants to rescue us from it. In Nahum, there was that one mountain that talked about God's anger. But later on, Nahum mentions another mountain. And here he says, behold the mountains of the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. Now from Christmas, maybe you recognize the good tidings, right? What does the angel say? I bring you good tidings of great joy, it will be at all people. Well, how could we have a slow to anger God who's also a furious volcano God, but right in the middle of that is another mountain, the feet of someone who brings good tidings and proclaims peace. There's an early church leader named Paul, and he's writing the book of Romans to a group of Christ followers who live in Rome. That's why it's called Romans. Go back one. And when he says that, he quotes this verse, and he says, this verse is about Jesus. Jesus comes to the mountain when we blew up, when we didn't handle anger the way we should, when we weren't slow to anger. He proclaims good tidings. I can still forgive you. I can still give you some leadership and some wisdom in your life. I can help you in this area, and I want to proclaim peace. I want to help you deal with some of the things inside. I want you to see how God has been long-suffering with you, been long of nose with you, how God has forgiven you. And when you realize how merciful he's been to you, then you start saying, maybe I could do some of that to other people. Show a little bit more mercy, a little bit more grace, a little more patience, because I'm doing unto others what God's done for me. Now, early on, we showed that video of Mike, the Vietnam vet. What's interesting about Mike is when he came in a helicopter, those two, that couple who had been hiking had been warned, don't be out there, don't go do that. Don't go chase that down. And they decided to do it anyway. And yet, everyone said, do not go out in the storm. The damage is too bad. It's too risky. And Michael Carnes jumps in his helicopter at great risk to himself, at great threat to himself, and he goes into a situation that they had relatively caused by being in danger, by not listening to wisdom. And he goes in to rescue them. And he's almost out of gas when he finally finds them, as you heard in the video. They get into the helicopter, and as they're in the helicopter, they're like, we had a couple other friends that we lost too. He's looking at the gas gauge, ding, ding, ding. All right, we're gonna give it a shot. And sure enough, they go around and they find them as well. Rescuing, rescuing, rescuing. The main metaphor of the Bible is very similar to that. The God is like that helicopter. He came in from on high to people doing pretty dumb things, friends who've been done pretty dumb things, and God says, at great risk to myself, even got myself crucified over this, I wanted to rescue you. That's why the Bible uses that metaphor of rescue and delivering so often. God came to deliver us from the power of darkness. You ever notice when you're angry, it's not just like, well, I should have known better. It's almost like a power comes over you. Like, it's more than just medical. It's more than I need to take a pill. It's like, I don't know who I was yesterday. I don't know who I was when I said that. It's like a power comes over you. So God came to deliver you, some translations say rescue you, from the power of darkness. To say, God, I need wisdom. I need you to rescue me from this power that keeps coming over me. It also says God came to deliver us from the present age. There are things in this evil age that are worth getting angry about. How people are treated, sex trade, slavery, injustice. But even in that, God, we ask you to come and fix this world right now. I'm going to relinquish judgment to you so I'm not carrying all that myself. Then lastly, God says, the same guy who wrote Romans says this, who will deliver me from this body of death? Man, there's just things in me that are broken. It's not just the world. It's not just the power. It's like, oh, I got this body of death that just keeps saying things and doing things I shouldn't do. Oh, God, would you deliver me from myself? I'm on the phone call with a stupid couch, and I'm like, God, deliver me from my self-righteousness. Deliver me from my tendency to not even think I'm wrong, to think I'm always right. Deliver me. Yeah, he comes in like a helicopter to deliver us. That's what wisdom's like. Doesn't say I told you so. He's like, all right, come on. Here's where you're at. Let's help you get back to someplace healthy. In fact, in a couple weeks, we're going to have a chance to hear firsthand from somebody that flies helicopters, fly planes. So Tammy Jo Schultz is going to be with us, all three services, and she is the first female Navy fighter pilot in America. But then she started working for Southwest Airlines, and she is in an incredible pickle, incredible danger, because one of the windows flies open. They lose somebody through that window on the plane. She's got a full tank of gas. She's got everybody on board, and all of a sudden, one of the engine goes out, and she's going to have to, in that moment, with her courage and her faith in God and Jesus, save all those lives. So 2 weeks, we're going to invite a friend to that on February 1st. She's going to be sharing at all three services. We have services we have seats available for all three services, but 9:45, often that service is 100% in this room full. So a lot of times there's overflow space there. So if you're looking for a seat in the auditorium, 11 o'clock or at the 8:30 service are both available, unless you don't mind sitting in the atrium, in which case come at 9:45. She's going to talk about she's able to rescue people because she had a hero who rescued her. So what does that mean for all of us? What does it mean for us to live this out? What does it mean for us to think about wisdom as a seismograph, a cryptodome, and a helicopter? Well, it simply means this. As I walk into my next week, I won't blow my top quickly at others because God didn't blow his top quickly at me. Now, we're going to mess up, make some mistakes, and we come back and we say, wow, if this message of Christianity is true, I'd really wrestle with it. I'd really look into it if I was you. The importance of being able to relinquish judgment to somebody who can handle it, because you've worn yourself out trying to carry it all. But also the idea that what if there was a God who chose to forgive you when you did some pretty dumb things, who is patient and slow to anger, long of nose with you. If you let that touch your heart, that somebody did that for me, then you suddenly go, you know what? I'm still annoyed at that guy. I'm still irritated. It still was wrong what happened. But I'm going to be a little bit more long-nosed. I'm not going to blow my top as quickly with others because there was a God who didn't blow his top at me. And boy, I deserved it. Who could have stood against that volcano of his anger if he'd been fair with me? And that begins to warm your heart and change your heart. I'll invite the band to come out to this next song. It's probably one you've heard many times, but probably not in this context. This song was written by Phil Collins, and the song was actually written when he was going through a divorce. I haven't talked to a lot of people over my 30 years of pastoral ministry. I don't think anything can hurt you deeper and cause you to see, I didn't even realize how angry I could be except divorce. Others of it's a business partner stabs us in the back, a child that betrays us, we're not allowed to see our grandkids because our kids have decided, blah, 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 just hurt and pain. It's just so many things that can make us angry, and we can handle it inappropriately. And divorce can be one of them. So Phil Collins writes this song, and a song he's just struck by is going through this divorce, that this woman he loved and was married to, he's so angry now that even if she was drowning, he's saying, I don't think I would help her. Oh, Lord. I need your help. Oh, Lord, I get in these moments and I just want to let it go and let it out of and waiting for this moment to just really tear and rip a new one. Oh, Lord, help me. The song is called In the Air Tonight. And it's not about the crazy story about him seeing somebody get killed, because that's not true at all. It's a story about a man who's wrestling with his own emotions during a time of divorce. And I want you to take a moment when you listen to the song and think about, are you able to discern what's happening in the air tonight? Are you feeling yourself begin to lose control? Are you feeling yourself letting those hurts fester? Are you feeling, feeling unappreciated here? It's getting kind of late. Would you ask God for wisdom to rescue you from yourself, to find his forgiveness, that you could recognize what's in the air when anger begins to take over? Let's listen together and maybe use it as a time to talk to God about your own anger. Boy, you think about that in the context of Phil Collins' story, and it makes a whole lot more sense, man. How many times I've felt that hurt growing and that pain growing, and you're like, oh my goodness, I could feel, I've been waiting for this moment. Oh Lord, I need help. Let me give you a chance to just pray. Maybe it's help for that wisdom. Maybe it's help for dealing with some of those hurts inside you. God wants to be that helicopter who can rescue us from ourselves. Let's pray together. Maybe you just want to start by saying, God, oh Lord, I need your help. I need to be rescued for some of the ways I've handled my emotions. Thanks for coming to earth to die for me. Thanks for dying on that cross for me. God, I want some of those good tidings that you promised on that mountain. I invite your peace into those broken spots inside me. Give me the courage to face some hurts, to let go of some anger. Maybe you want to say this, say, God, I'm going to relinquish judgment to you. Maybe you want to say it this way, God, I'm going to fire myself from being judge of the world today. Or maybe not the world. Say, God, I'm going to fire myself from being judge of my ex-spouse, of my prodigal son, of that boss, that business partner. Then maybe one last prayer. Just say, God, help me to be long-nosed and not blow my top quickly at the people around me. God, I ask the same thing. God, that my anger shows up in different ways than others, but I certainly can feel that frustration building, that self-righteousness building, that I know better than you building in me. God, I just ask that you would be a gentle tap on the shoulder, that you would be a voice of wisdom to call my emotions into account as well. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.